Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
But first, you may have been hearing about these strikes that Israel carried out against Iran overnight. Blasts were held in the central province of Isfahan, although it's not clear what was targeted. Iran, we know, is on high alert because Israel said it would respond to the Iranian attack against it on Saturday night when it fired more than 300 drones and missiles in its first ever direct attack on Israel. In a moment, I'll speak to Lise Doucette, who's the BBC's chief international correspondent. But first, I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, who's defence editor with The Economist. And Shashank, there's almost a muted response to this from both sides and a very careful international message from many countries who are watching closely what's going to happen next, but no increased signs of concern, would you agree, today? And how would you assess this overnight attack?
Well, first of all, if what we see is accurate, if the early reports are accurate, this is considerably more restrained an Israeli strike than what many officials feared might occur over the last week or so. There was a concern, for example, that Israel might choose to strike nuclear facilities. And indeed, Iran does have nuclear facilities in Isfahan province where explosions occurred. But all those nuclear facilities are safe, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran says it shot down three small drones, and that was the sum total of the attack. And whether or not that's true, there seems to be some indication of a strike on an airbase. Whether or not that's true, the fact that this is Iran's claim, the fact that Iranian airspace is open again, the fact that Israelis are not indicating that there's more to come, all of this, to me, points to de-escalation in the days ahead.
Mm-hmm. So what message do you think Israel was hoping to send to Iran?
I think there's really two messages. One of them is that if you conduct a large-scale missile attack on Iranian soil, Israeli soil, there will be a response. If you cross the Rubicon by directly striking us rather than striking us via Syria or Iraq or Lebanon, we will respond against your soil. So we will also break the rules and match your escalation. However, under great pressure from Western allies, and Israel here is signaling as much to its allies as it is to Iran, it's saying this is the end of the matter for us. This is a relatively calibrated attack, and we are not interested in destabilizing the regime, in destroying your nuclear sites, or inviting you to then step back up to the plate and lob even more missiles back at us. We see this as a kind of drawing a line under this, mm-hmm. and I think that's how Iran sees it as well.
Because even Iran saying that what was launched in that province came from within Iranian territory, all signs seem to be pointing to de-escalation, would you agree?
Well, I will say I agree with that. But on the point about where the attack came from, the use of smaller drones would suggest that the attack came from a shorter range. On the one hand, that's not good news for Iran. It indicates that Israel may have agents inside Iran. And indeed, I'll just say this is not the first time Israel is thought to have used drones to strike Iranian facilities. It did it certainly in January last year when I think a drone facility in Iran was struck. But I will say the other thing is Israel may have chosen to go down this road rather than fire missiles or indeed conduct airstrikes, because to do that, it would have had to more explicitly violate the airspace of its Arab neighbours. And those Arab neighbours, having just helped Israel to bat away so many Iranian drones, countries like Jordan, for instance, I think Israel realised that would have been a diplomatically unwise move. But the result, as you say, is, I think, now likely to be de-escalation.
And yet we have some of the hardliners in the Israeli government complaining about this publicly, saying that it was a feeble attack. Do you think that issues will arise there?
I don't think they will, actually. I think that you will always have fringe elements who sort of push for more. We saw that from you referring to Ben-Gvir, a very extreme member of the Israeli government, very far-right member of the government. But others in the Likud party have said, we're proud of this. This is a great response. I think ultimately, just as Iran could sell its attack on Israel as a form of justified vengeance, even though, you know, nothing really got through in a substantial way. Similarly, Israel will be able to sell this as sufficient action, not least because Netanyahu will be saying internally, I'd have liked to have done more, but the Americans, along with others, Europeans, are telling me it's imperative that we are restrained, and I must listen to that at such a sensitive time when other things are on my plate, like an operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah.
All right, stay with us if you can, Shashank, because I want to come back to that point, but to bring in Lise here. Good morning, Lise, and thank you for joining us. You've been listening there to what Shashank has had to say and his analysis of this. I mean, the two big questions that people will have this morning is, you know, will the hardliners in Iran want to push back now against this strike? And does Israel have any further plans for more attacks on Iran? And what do you think the answers to those questions are?
Well, in this growing conflagration, beyond the escalating tit-for-tat that we're seeing, there's also the broader issue of deterrence. Both Iran and Israel want to make absolutely clear that if their enemy, their arch enemy attacks, they will pay a deadly price. And so in this escalating tension we're seeing, there are some broader strategic goals. Iran has made it clear ever since the April 1st attack on its consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus, which killed seven of its Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard officials, including the most senior commander in the region, that its doctrine had changed. It was no longer what it used to describe as strategic patience. In other words, playing a long game in which it wouldn't necessarily strike back, strike directly when it was provoked or threatened or indeed struck. Now it talks about strategic patience, a new equation. We heard from the president, Ibrahim Raisi, a few days ago saying even the tiniest attack, invasion by Israel would meet a harsh response. And I think this is why this morning we are seeing Iranian officials playing down this strike, even mocking it, saying we don't know where it was attacked from. It may not have been coming from foreign territory. In other words, making it sound like this was so small, so insignificant, that it doesn't deserve a response from us.
Yes, but why take that attitude when they have promised a harsh response to any incursion?
Iran is painfully aware of the consequences. This is why it has played such a cautious game through the last 6 months of the Israel-Gaza war, always reacting to attacks on its assets or individuals in Syria and in other neighboring countries. With restraint or through its proxies. It does not want to get into an all-out war with Israel and even more importantly with the United States. It would suffer catastrophically. The man who makes the final decision, he turns 85 today, Ayatollah Khamenei, he came to power, he assumed the mantle of supreme leader in 1989. The year after Iran's catastrophic eight-year-long war with Iraq ended. As many as 200,000 Iranians were killed. It still cast a long, dark shadow over Iran. It's said to still weigh on his mind. And although he was under pressure not to lose face, under pressure from his most radical Revolutionary Guards, he is their commander-in-chief, under pressure, too, to restore or to consolidate Iran's perceived prestige as the fulcrum of the so-called axis of resistance, the proxies, the network of proxies and allies, non-state armed militias that have played an active role and have become emboldened during the Israel-Gaza war. Mm-hmm. But he was mindful that it had to be calculated and calibrated in such a way not to provoke this dangerous escalatory spiral toward an all-out war.
Okay, can I come back, Shashank, to you and to the Rafah question? Because we had reports from Egypt yesterday that the Americans had said to Israel, do not retaliate against Iran. And if you agree not to retaliate, we will then not so much give you your blessing, but stand back if you want to go into Rafah, as Benjamin Netanyahu had said so many times over the last number of weeks he wanted to do. Do you think that that is correct, that that could have happened and that might be what we see playing out here this morning?
US officials are denying that they've given such a green light for an operation in Rafah as a quid pro quo for restraint. Of course, Israel might choose to present it as such and use that as leverage to say, we did what you asked, now you must do what we ask. However, I think that actually the events of the last 2 weeks, Iran's strike, the retaliation, this does not wipe clean the diplomatic slate. And I think there is immense frustration in the United States over Israel's failure to listen, over ongoing civilian casualties, the strike on the aid workers. And although, yes, they are still sending weapons and they're still hesitant to use their leverage, I think there's a lot of people in the US system, including the State Department, who are saying, we don't think an operation in Rafah is a good idea unless you can evacuate more than a million civilians. And we don't think you can do that. We don't think you're capable of evacuating, feeding, providing medical care to such a large civilian exodus. And so I still think there is great skepticism about any Rafah operation. And indeed, I think there'll be another push now to focus instead on a hostage deal.
But the Israelis are still intent on going into Rafah.
The Israeli government is intent on going to Rafah, although we have to be careful what we mean by intent, because we initially heard from Benjamin Netanyahu that the deadline was, I think, the beginning of Ramadan. And of course, that deadline passed without incident. We then saw Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister, essentially say this had been delayed. So whilst they are intent on it, I think it's also clear they understand there's a limit to how far they can thumb their nose at their principal ally on the world stage. Mm-hmm. And so we could see that deadline pushed to the right day after day.
Lise, what is your assessment on that situation in Rafah and what might happen now?
You know, I'm sure Shashank agrees with me. You wake up every day and you're not quite sure what's going to happen next. I flew out of Israel yesterday from where there was absolute gridlock at the airport. Israelis leaving for the Passover holiday, and all of the Israeli analysts were saying, oh, no, there won't be an attack on Iran before Passover. The Israeli military chiefs and political leaders wouldn't want to disrupt this holiest of holidays for Israelis. And then you wake up the next day and Israelis realize, oh, they've done it. So we just don't know. Prime Minister Netanyahu has made it repeatedly clear that Rafah is on the agenda. And yes, as you mentioned, there are reports that he's doing deals behind, saying, if you want me to do this, then I want you to do that. That is absolutely possible. Prime Minister Netanyahu continues to say that there are four brigades of Hamas left in Rafah. He needs to go into Rafah in order to complete the task. But there are senior members of his war cabinet who say we cannot defeat Hamas militarily. Let's make a deal so we can bring the hostages home. Making that deal is hard because Hamas has very hard-line demands. Most of all, they want a permanent ceasefire in Israeli forces to pull out. So I think Rafah is still in the mix, but it is a very, very, very dangerous and complicated mix right now.
He is on a political, very tricky ground politically, though, Lise, isn't he? Because he made that commitment from the get-go on October 7th that he would eliminate Hamas. So from his perspective, and from the perspective of the people who believe that he is going to do that and accept that that promise is one to be kept, he will have to go into Rafah.
As we've just been discussing with Israel and Iran, it's all about the narrative. What does eliminating Hamas mean? If he achieves one of the major goals, which is to capture or kill the top leaders of Hamas, the masterminds behind the October 7th murderous rampage, then he could declare victory, saying, we've got them. And under pressure from military advisors from the United States and others saying, listen, there are other ways to fight this war. You don't have to be conducting this ground operation, which is taking a staggering number of lives and in the long run could make Israel more insecure rather than more secure. So I think we have to wait and see. And the bottom line is that many believe it's not possible to destroy Hamas militarily anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think we just, there is still more fighting to come in this war, but there's also diplomacy and there's also going to be deals to be done. Does Prime Minister Netanyahu want to drag this war on so he doesn't face elections? so he can possibly perhaps wait till November, hoping that he might get a better deal if President Trump returns to power. There are just so many elements, so many interests, so many powers, and so much pressure in this mix.
So, Shashank, it's just very difficult to predict what the next act is going to be.
It's very difficult. There are so many moving parts. We've discussed Iran, Israel. We've discussed Rafah and Gaza and Hamas. And of course, we can't forget Lebanon as well, which was in some ways the original cause of this most recent conflagration. It was Israel striking a consular annex housing Iran's Revolutionary Guards in Damascus. What were they doing in Damascus? Well, they were probably aiding and abetting and providing weapons to proxy forces, including Hezbollah in Lebanon, which Israel is gravely concerned about. Some Israeli leaders want to attack preemptively. So, even that northern front could be very, very febrile in the days and weeks ahead.
And Lise mentioned, you know, what might happen from November if there's another Trump presidency. Do you think that is on Benjamin Netanyahu's mind? Can he even think ahead that far? Is that what he's trying to do, cling on until we get to that point?
It's a long way away, but of course he's a great survivor. He's got his enemies inside his cabinet. They're unable to pry him from office, even if they can, of course. Don't forget, Israel's political system is such that I think there's a 3-month transition period in which Netanyahu would have even more powers than he does now before you had an election in the first place. So if he might be thinking, if I can limp on till the summer, keeping these things alive, then if I can get to Trump, I have some of my good friends back in the White House, people like Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, much more pro-Israel officials than he will find even in the Biden administration. So that's got to be in the back of his mind, I suspect.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Shashank Joshi, defence editor with The Economist, and Lise Doucette, who's the BBC's chief international economist. Coming up next, we'll find out why primary school class sizes here are likely to come down.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.